Okay, so it's fantastic that you're all here. Thank you for coming. As I explained in the email that I sent out to you about this call, it just seemed that, like most of you, I'm sure we're all more or less stuck at home. And since we're stuck at home, it seemed like a great opportunity to, as I said in the email, educate while we isolate. I'm kind of a natural born teacher in multiple domains. So I was a school teacher way back when, and now I teach meditation and spiritual philosophy, but I actually love to teach. So this seemed like a great opportunity to offer some interesting opportunities for us to come together and for me to share some things with you and for all of us to learn. So the series is called Artists of Possibility, Exploring the Varieties of Visionary Genius. And for those of you who may not know me as well, I teach meditation and I teach spiritual philosophy. I teach awakening, and I have for many years. But for me, the purpose of teaching meditation and spiritual philosophy is to liberate us from conditioned ways of thinking, conditioned ways of seeing, conditioned ways of being, so that we can act as what I call artists of possibility. And so in this series, we're going to do one tonight and then three more Tuesday nights following. I'm highlighting four people that I consider to be artists of possibility. Obviously, there are an infinite number of people I could have chosen. I just chose some that happen to be my favorites and happen to be people I think would be interesting to share with you. Tonight, we'll speak about Fernando Pessoa, and then next week, Charles Sanders Peirce, and after that, Anais Nin, and after that, Gertrude Stein. And each one of those people is an original and extraordinary thinker, a pioneer, a visionary. You can't say enough good things about them. And in my opinion, they are all artists of possibility. So if I was going to say, well, what is an artist of possibility? I would say an artist of possibility is a particular kind of artist. You know, all artists create, but some artists actually create new possibilities. They extend what's possible into places that weren't possible before. And those are the artists that I get particularly interested in. And in different ways, I feel that the four artists of possibility we'll be exploring over the next few weeks all fit into that category. And so they are literally working in the realm of possibility, and they are geniuses because they bring into being something that is novel. You know, novelty is much more rare than you might think. It's not unheard of. It's not that new things don't happen. They just don't happen very often. And when something new happens, people tend to notice. You know, we live in a culture which tends to promote a lot of things as new and improved. Most of them aren't that new. A lot of them aren't even all that improved. But occasionally in the world of cultural and intellectual development, something new occurs. And that, generally speaking, gets noticed because it's different, because it's authentically different. And the four people we'll be speaking about, we're all pushing something new into the world. And that's why they got noticed. Now, there's another interesting fact about people who are bringing something new into the world is that although they tend to get noticed eventually, they're often not noticed at the time they're doing it. And that was largely true of the four people that we're going to speak about in this series. And it's certainly true of Fernando Pessoa. So let me start then with Fernando Pessoa. He's a Portuguese poet. He looks exactly like the person on my shirt because I wore my Fernando Pessoa shirt in order to show you what he looks like. And the Fernando Pessoa quote on my shirt says, I'd woken up early and I took a long time getting ready to exist. So I'd woken up early and I took a long time getting ready to exist. It's a very Fernando Pessoa-like quote. And I'm imagining that very few of you are all that familiar with Fernando Pessoa because he's not all that well known. I've been interested in Fernando Pessoa since I was in high school. So that's, you know, 30, almost 40 years ago, you know. And the reason I was interested in him is because my cultural heritage is Portuguese. And in high school, I studied the Portuguese language. My language teacher studied in Portugal, and he was a fan of Fernando Pessoa. So I had the opportunity to hear about Fernando Pessoa at an early age. Not that I ever read him at the time, but the name stuck in my mind, and something that I had heard about him made me very curious. And then it was, you know, many years later that I actually started learning a little bit about him. And then over the last few years, I've been very fascinated. The last 6 or 7 years, I've been very fascinated by him. And that's why I wanted to present him to you. So just, I don't want to give you too much biographical information, but I believe he was born in 1888. He lived in Lisbon, Portugal, until he was 7 years old. His father died when he was five. His mother remarried, and his mom and his stepdad, and he moved to South Africa, where he lived for the next 10 years. And then he moved back to Lisbon 10 years later. He lived about another 35 years, maybe 40 years, and never left Lisbon again. Lisbon was his home and the place that he loved, and he essentially never left. During his lifetime, he wrote, he did editorial work, he founded a few literary magazines. I would say he more or less kind of scraped by in existence as a writer, and probably did a number of other things. He published a bit in his lifetime. He got somewhat known, actually about 2 years before he died. He published a book of poems called The Message, either The Message or The Messenger. I think it was The Message. It's in Portuguese, of course. And it was a kind of patriotic collection of poems that gained him a lot of reputation. So that when he died 2 years later, you couldn't say that he was well known, but his obituaries in the Portuguese news were very favorable because he had 2 years earlier published this book that had become very popular and was well respected. Aside of that book, he did publish a variety of poems in magazines and in different places. He wrote in Portuguese and in English and in French, and he published a little bit in all three, but really didn't publish that much. What's very interesting about Fernando Pessoa is that he, during his lifetime, he published under four different names. His own name, Fernando Pessoa, and he published under the name of Alberto Cairo, under the name of Álvaro de Campo, and under the name of Ricardo Ruiz. So those four names were all authors whose poems were written by Fernando Pessoa. And one of the things that's very interesting about Pessoa, now, he's considered to be certainly the greatest modern Portuguese poet and arguably the greatest Portuguese poet of all time, depending on who you talk to. And the other three poets, Alberto Cairo, Álvaro de Campo, and Ricardo Ruiz, who were all, of course, also Fernando Pessoa, but had their own styles, very different from his, are generally all considered world-class poets in their own right. They each have their own bodies of work. He actually published more in their names than in his own. And so it was always considered quite a feat that he managed to write under the name under four different names with different styles and have them be so such high quality, produced such high quality poetry. So that was kind of Fernando Pessoa's life. And he died fairly young. And then there's one of the, you know, there's these great literary stories. And this is one of those, which is 10 years after he died, someone found a trunk. And in the trunk, there were 19 notebooks and tens of thousands of handwritten pages of writing by Fernando Pessoa that nobody knew and existed before. You know, he lived a very quiet life. He found it very difficult to finish any of his writing, that which is one of the reasons he published so little in his lifetime. But he had this trunk full of all the stuff he'd been writing, and he wrote an enormous amount in his lifetime. So this trunk was discovered, and then scholars started going through it, and they started to think, oh my God, this stuff is amazing. This has all been locked up in a trunk for 10 years? And not only did they find out it's amazing, but they found out he didn't just write under three other names. They don't know how many names he's written under, but the highest count that I heard is 172. So there were 172 different names that he produced writing under. And some of them have been collected. Some of them have not been collected. Scholars are still going through the stuff in the trunk to figure it all out. Because a lot of it is written, supposedly it's written on the back of napkins, on little scraps of paper, because he was writing all the time on anything he could find, and then it all just ended up in his trunk. And then it's the scholar's job to go through it and try and sort through. One of the major events that came out of that trunk is this book. So this is an English edition. The book is called The Book of Disquiet. And Fernando Pessoa's Book of Disquiet is considered to be his masterwork. It's essentially, in his own words, a semi-fictional memoir. It was written actually by two people, but the one that tends to get credit was someone named Bernardo Soares. Bernardo Soares, of course, is also Fernando Pessoa. But this is a book by Bernardo Soares, and he was a bookkeeper, a shopkeeper, a fairly depressed shopkeeper who was also happened to be enlightened and an advocate of dreaming. Fernando Pessoa said that Bernardo Soares, who wrote this book, was one of the what he called heteronyms, one of the characters that was closest to the actual Fernando Pessoa. So there you go. That's the kind of background of the story. There's this writer writes an enormous amount of poetry and prose. He wrote philosophy papers. He wrote critiques of other writers. He wrote history. And he wrote a little bit of stuff in his own name, but a vast majority of it was in enormous number of other names, up to and surpassing 172, according to what I've read. Now, before I go further, because the story gets more interesting the more they learn about Pessoa, but I'm going to read you just a couple of things from the Book of Disquiet, so a couple of very short lines. So this, fairly early on, he writes, "Let us create an art quite different from any other art." And when he writes that, at least in my reading, I can only assume that he means the art of dreaming, because a big part, a lot of this book is about the power of dreaming and about his system for how you can become a master dreamer. You know, he felt that his dreams were more real to him than the external reality. He thought of the reality that we call reality as the dream we all agree to call real. It didn't seem to be any more real to him than any of his other dreams. In fact, it was the one he liked the least. He liked a lot of his other dreams a lot better than this one, so he spent more time in them. To continue with the theme of dreaming, he describes this in the book. He said, "The highest stage of dreaming is reached when, having created a cast of characters," which we now know he did, "we live them all at the same time. We are all those souls jointly and interactively. So that's what he considered to be the highest achievement of a master dreamer. And so the thing that starts to make Fernando Pessoa look very unusual is his adamant claim. You know, normally when an author writes in other names, you call those pseudonyms, right? They're not you're the author writing in various names. He was very adamant about the fact that he was not doing that. That what he was creating were heteronyms, not pseudonyms. A pseudonym is a name that an author, various names that an author writes in. But he said, my heteronyms, they are not me. They are other beings writing through my body. He was also an occultist. He was very interested in the occult. I have a lot of side stories that sometimes come out. So Fernando Pessoa, there's a great picture of him. No one's exactly sure if the person in the picture is who they say it is, but some people are sure it is. Fernando Pessoa was friends with Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley was the English Satanist known as the Beast, you know, at one time spoken about as the most dangerous person in the world. Aleister Crowley was also an astrologer. Fernando Pessoa was an astrologer, and Pessoa saw some of the charts that the Beast had created, and he saw that there were mistakes in it, so he wrote him a letter correcting his astrology charts. And Aleister Crowley was so impressed with the corrections that they started a little bit of a friendship. I don't know how close they got, but there is this famous picture of the two of them playing chess in a coffee shop in Lisbon somewhere. Now, one of the famous stories about Fernando Pessoa and Aleister Crowley, Crowley had a consort, a woman that was someone that he would practice sexual rites with and magic with. And one of his trips to visit Fernando Pessoa, he brought this woman with him. And they had a big fight in Portugal, and she left him. And Crowley was crushed. He was supposedly crushed. He didn't know what to do. So he and Fernando Pessoa came up with a plan. There's a place in Cascais, which is a little town outside of Lisbon. It's called Boca do Inferno, which basically means the mouth of hell. It's a deep cliff edge over down to the ocean. And so they had a plan, which is Crowley left Portugal, but then Fernando Pessoa told all the newspapers in Lisbon that he had seen Aleister Crowley jump into the Boca do Inferno and commit suicide because he was so brokenhearted over this woman having left him. So Crowley thought when the woman found out that he had killed himself over her, that she would come back. That didn't actually happen. But in the meantime, the word got spread everywhere. And then 6 months later, Crowley showed up somewhere in Paris at an art show and revealed the truth. So that was Pessoa's little adventures with Aleister Crowley and the local newspapers. But Fernando Pessoa claimed that the people that wrote through him were not pseudonyms. They were heteronyms. They were actual people. They were actual entities that would inhabit his body and write. Now, there are many interesting things about this. As I said earlier, the writing styles of the various people that wrote through him are all quite different. And in one of the books that I read about Pessoa, someone who was a literary critic said, generally speaking, when an author has pseudonyms, if you know the author well enough, you can see little bits of their style running through all the pseudonyms. But he said, in Fernando Pessoa's case, that's not possible. These look like completely different people writing. They don't look like the same person writing under different names. The other thing that was interesting is that Fernando Pessoa himself found it, his writing process was incredibly labored. He really worked and worked and worked over his writing and edited and re-edited and re-edited over and over again. But at least one of his most famous heteronyms, Alberto Cairo, always wrote completely stream of consciousness as fast as he could write. And whenever Alberto Cairo wrote through Fernando Pessoa's body, that's how the writing came out. Completely stream of consciousness beginning to end. And Pessoa himself was always upset, didn't understand why he couldn't do that. Like, he seemed to be able to do it when Alberto Cairo was in charge, but why couldn't he do it when Fernando Pessoa was in charge? You know, why was he getting such different results? In addition to their different writing styles, the heteronyms all had histories. Ricardo Reis was born in Brazil. He was a doctor. He had a whole history, involved his mother, and eventually he came back to Lisbon. And Álvaro de Campo had a different history. Alberto Cairo had a, you know, they were very elaborately full characters. And so what I want to point out with Pessoa, what I feel in him, because when you're thinking, when I'm thinking about people that I consider to be artists of possibility, I'm always trying to see what is it that's compelling them. You know, because in all the people that I'm, that we'll be looking at in this series, you'll see something compelled them that they would not stop pursuing for their whole life. However long their life was, they never stopped. When we speak in a couple of, two more weeks about Anais Nin, we'll see that she started writing, diaries when she was 11 years old and continued to write them until the end of her life at, you know, almost 70. And she never stopped. You know, this is a kind of compulsion. And Fernando Pessoa similarly just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. Hardly ever got published, but he just kept writing and writing. So what was it that was compelling him? In his case, I feel very certain that he was compelled by deep questions about the nature of identity. Who am I? What is an identity? He, all through his writing, especially in the Book of Disquiet, he expresses doubts about his own existence. So for instance, he says, "I myself don't know if the I am setting before you in these serpent pages really exists or is merely a false, self-created aesthetic concept of who I am." So he was always very confused about his own existence because he had all these other beings that would inhabit him and come through him. So he was always very confused about who he was. He says, "I never know if the person I feel myself to be really is me, or if I merely think that I am." And then very late in the book, he describes an awakening experience. And it would be my contention that an enormous amount of his explorations of identity stem from this experience. Now, they might have happened, his exploration of identity preceded this experience, but you know, I don't believe that when people have spiritual experiences that they're limited in time anyway. I think your whole life was drawn into being by that experience. Maybe you didn't happen to have the experience until you were 30, but it didn't mean that experience wasn't what your life was about before then. So in his description of his spiritual experience, which is a bit too long to read, but I'll just read a little bit of it. It says, "In a moment of enlightenment, I realized that I am nobody, absolutely nobody. I myself am the center that exists only because the geometry of the abyss demands it. I am the nothing around which all this spins. I exist only so that it can spin. I am a center that exists only because every circle has one. So at some point, Fernando Pessoa had a profound experience of emptiness, emptiness of self, of no self. And it's clear to me that his earlier life and his earlier explanations with the heteronyms were supported by this deep experience of emptiness, even though he perhaps hadn't had it yet. But he writes a little bit later, because I am nothing, I can imagine myself to be anything. If I were somebody, I wouldn't be able to do that. So it's this deep emptiness in his being, this profound lack of identity that compels him to keep exploring different personalities. And he started doing this when he was in South Africa, when he was like 10 or 11 years old. He was already writing in other people's names for school newspapers and things. So this was a very early. So then of course there's the chicken or the egg. Was his writing in other people's names and his fascination around that, did that lead him to have the experience of emptiness? Or was that experience of emptiness already latent in his unconscious and it was driving him to explore identities? You know, I'm sure it's some of both and we'll never exactly know. One of the reasons I love Fernando Pessoa is that I really share his compulsion to explore identity, and I have for a long time. When I was young, I worked in a grocery store. I worked in the deli department of the grocery store. And I lived in a small town, and I worked a lot. I was, you know, high school years. But I would often adopt a different personality when I was working, usually with a bad accent, either an English accent or a German accent, and I would give myself a different name. And, you know, if I was the English one, then I was very gregarious and fun-loving and made a lot of jokes. But, you know, there was other ones where I was much more dour and sour with everybody. And I really got into it, and I would not give it up. You know, and of course, it's a small town, so everybody actually knew me. So it wasn't like anybody was being fooled by this act. But yeah, I guess they just put up with it. But I know that I enjoyed stepping into another identity. When I was, you know, years later, I worked as a director of a group home for adjudicated teens. And there were a few Halloweens where, because we were always trying to figure out, like, what could we do on Halloween that would keep all the teenagers entertained, because for some reason they hated being in the group home on Halloween, and we always felt we were trying to find good ways to hold their attention. So one year I discovered a good one, so I kept doing it every year for a little while, which is sometime in the morning I would start to pretend to have bad stomach aches, and then I would start holding my stomach, and then I actually taught in a garage, believe it or not, but this is kind of how it worked. It was a garage. So I would walk out of the garage into the backyard, and I would sort of writhe in pain and start screaming in agony, holding my belly, and then contorting in weird shapes. And then when I was done, I would have this really bad accent that was supposed to be Transylvanian. I would pretend that I was Igor, and I would be really mean to them all day. And they would completely freak out. And I would scream at them, and I would demand their work. And if it wasn't good, I would ridicule them. And I kept telling them that I was Jeff's cousin, Igor, who had died in Transylvania 300 years ago because an ox cart had run over him. And the only time he can come through to this world is on Halloween, when the veil between the living and the dead is thinnest. And I mean, honest to God, like they, for the first, you know, half hour, they just thought it was a joke. But come like hour three, they were starting to like go into the director's office to say there was a problem. And then I would leave the, day still in my Igor personality. And then the next day I would come back and pretend I didn't remember anything. I would say, wow, it's so weird. I just don't remember anything that happened yesterday. I just remember having that stomach ache and going outside. And you know, we would just let it go. We just kept it going. We never let them in on it. I think they sort of figured it out. But anyway, they liked being fooled. But like Fernando Pessoa, I found that when I was in my Igor persona, because I always found it a bit of a struggle to be stern enough with the kids, you know, as many people do. The kids all liked me and I liked them. And I had to really push myself to get stern when it was time. But when I was Igor, it was so easy. I mean, I found it so easy to be stern. I always found that fascinating. Like how come when I think I'm Jeff, I find it difficult, but when I pretend to be Igor, it's so easy. And I think this is one of the things that Fernando Pessoa must have been on about, you know, that the different personas that he would adopt, that he was certain, and they may have been, I don't know, they may have been actual other entities working through him, but either way, he was fascinated by the fact that the different personas had completely different capacities that he, Fernando Pessoa, himself didn't necessarily have. So for those of us who are interested in transformation and growth and enlightenment, I think that we as yet often do not value the power of imagination enough. You know, that we actually have the power to imagine ourselves different. And I think that's what Fernando Pessoa was so completely excited about or entranced by, that you can imagine yourself different. Now, the other thing about Pessoa, which I haven't said anything about, is he's an incredibly depressed person. I found this book very difficult to get all the way through, because after reading, I could only read so much at a time before I needed a break, because he's very, you know, he's got this very interesting mix of enlightened, fascinating, and depressed, you know, and it kind of runs through the whole book. Now, what's also interesting about him is, you know, he had all these characters had relationships. They weren't just characters. They were all in relationship with each other. So Alberto Cairo wrote this book. This happens to be a Portuguese edition. O Guardador de Rebanhos, The Guardian of the Sheep. This is Alberto Cairo's most famous collection of poems. There's 80 pages of poems. They were supposedly written in one go, beginning to the end, obviously through Fernando Pessoa, Stream of Consciousness. They're considered to be fantastic poems. Alberto Cairo, the author of these, was the poet. He was the master poet in Fernando Pessoa's world. Ricardo Reis and Álvaro de Campo and Fernando Pessoa were his three leading disciples. And there's an essay that Álvaro de Campo writes, Reflections on My Master. You know, he wrote an essay about his teacher. And in that essay, he writes about the first time that Fernando Pessoa met Alberto Cairo. He met him. And that, you know, the three of them used to go with a few other people and meet with Alberto Cairo, and then he would teach them. He would teach them about poetry and about life. And this particular night, which was the first night Fernando Pessoa had come, Alberto Cairo read the Guardador de Rebaños poems. And Fernando Pessoa himself, I think it's actually written in here. Oh yeah, I'll just read you the way Alvaro de Campo described it. He said, the strangest case is that of Fernando Pessoa, who doesn't exist, strictly speaking. But he met Cairo a little bit before I did, on March 8th, 1914, according to what he told me. Cairo had come to spend a week in Lisbon, and it was then that Pessoa met him. After hearing him recite The Keeper of Sheep, he went home in a fever and wrote the six poems of Slanting Rain in one go. So the one time Fernando Pessoa was able to manage to write in spontaneous writing was the night he first met Alberto Cairo and heard the Keeper of Sheep. Now, of course, you have to remember that Alberto Cairo is coming through Fernando Pessoa. Alvaro de Campo, who's writing about Fernando Pessoa meeting Alberto Cairo, is also coming through Pessoa. There's another character named T. Cross. He writes reviews of Alberto Cairo's poetry in English for English magazines, and those would get published sometimes. So, you know, Pessoa is living in this world of his own creation, you know, and it makes me ask questions like, did Fernando Pessoa remember meeting Alberto Cairo on March 14th before Alvaro de Campo wrote about it in the memoir? Or did Pessoa learn about the meeting while it was being written about by a third person? So one last thing I want to say about the writing process and about my own experience of writing, and another reason why I'm so compelled by Pessoa. 2 years ago, I wrote a novel just because I wanted to write one. And I wrote it Stream of Consciousness. In fact, it ended up being about 180 pages. And I would write about, you know, 5 to 20 pages a day, depending on the day. But I had a rule for myself, which is I never went back and read what I'd written before. I just went best I could on memory the next day. And I never edited anything. I never went back and looked at it. I had someone edit it afterwards for me. I've actually never read the whole book all the way through. I just wrote it once and published it. I've never read it all the way through. But sometimes I would get so deep into the writing that as I was writing, the characters would do things that I hadn't intended for them to do, literally in real time. And the time when it was the most dramatic is I was writing a scene about a woman character who was, she was in a conversation with someone on the train, and then she left the train and he ran after her because he needed to ask her one more question. And in my head, I was planning for her to run. I had this whole plan. She was going to run through a crowded parking lot, and then she was going to duck into a garage, and then there was going to be a chase. That was going to be the next scene was going to be this chase. And I watched my fingers type, and they typed, "Hey, stop, I need to talk to you," which is what I intended for them to type. And then they were supposed to type, and she ran it through, you know, into the crowd. Instead, they typed, she turned around and said, "Okay," and waited. And then I thought, oh shit, what do I do? This wasn't my plan, you know? And I really had the sense that somehow that story was writing itself. And in spite of the fact that I thought there was some way that story had an independent existence from mine, my desire to write and my ideas about it were somehow merging with a story that wanted to be told. And from that point on in the story, it became very difficult for me to tell if I was writing a story or if I was just typing the story that wanted to be told. And sometimes it would feel more like I was writing in the old-fashioned way, and sometimes it would feel more like the story was writing itself through me. And when I read Pessoa, and I've spent some time, you know, reading the Book of Disquiet, reading the poetry of the various authors, reading some of his selected prose and his philosophical papers, but the more I read, the more I enter into that a state that I think was the state he was writing from, where it's very difficult to tell what's real. And in many ways, you know, Pessoa, who was writing in the early 20th century, he reminds me of another of my favorite writers, the science fiction author Philip K. Dick. And similar to Pessoa, Philip K. Dick was very compelled by questions of identity. So in his, you know, the movie Total Recall, which was based on a short story called We'll Remember It For You Wholesale, it's a future where people can't afford to go on vacations, but then there's this company that develops a technology, and they'll basically implant the memory of a vacation into your brain. So then you don't have to go on vacation, which is too expensive. You just get the memory implanted. And then, of course, the question is, if you remember a vacation that never happened, did it actually happen? How do you know? The company, part of their guarantee in selling it to you is you won't be able to tell it's not real. So if you can't tell the memory is not real, how do you know it didn't actually happen? And as the movie unfolds, that's sort of what the whole movie's always playing with. And I, simultaneously to getting in interested in Fernando Pessoa, I also spent some time getting into Philip K. Dick. The Fernando Pessoa, the downside of Fernando Pessoa is he's a bit depressed, so you have to be willing to go through that. The downside of Philip K. Dick is he's totally paranoid, so you have to be willing to go through that. So there seems to be downsides to a lot of geniuses. But still, this the questions of identity that are being brought up, I find utterly fascinating and compelling. And when I wrote a book called The Soul of the New Self about earlier spiritual experiences I had of feeling like I had stepped out of the way by letting go very deeply of the limited sense of Jeff, the limited sense of my personality. And in so doing, had created the space for, I don't know how to describe it, but it, for a bigger entity to step into me, to step through me. And so one of the ways that I see the spiritual life is that, you know, I teach meditation and I teach philosophy because I'm teaching people how to let go of their mind, how to let go of their conclusions, how to let go of engagement with their current reality and their current sense of self, so that there's freedom, you know, spiritual freedom, freedom of spirit in the system. Because I believe that bigger, you know, what's sometimes called the big S self, you know, a bigger self, a bigger identity, a more cosmic identity will step in through us if we relax out of the way. And I feel like in his own way, Fernando Pessoa was exploring what he called it dreaming. He spoke about it as dreaming and getting so good at dreaming that you could create this cast of characters and you could simultaneously be all of them. You know, you're so fluid in identity. You know, that's what I see in Pessoa. It was an exploration of fluidity of identity. How can you become so fluid in your identity that new possibilities start to inhabit you? In my identity is one where I edit and can't finish anything and labor over everything, but I'm fluid enough to let go. And I let someone like Alberto Cairo step in and write stream of consciousness through my body so inspiringly that I then go home as Fernando Pessoa and write my own six poems, stream of consciousness, for the first time in my life. First, and actually, as it turned out, the last time in his life, because he was never able to do that again. So Fernando Pessoa is, I consider him to be an artist of possibility. That doesn't mean that he's the most awakened, most enlightened being, but it means he was exploring new possibilities. He was exploring things that were new, that didn't exist yet. This whole, you know, it doesn't seem as radical now because we've had a Philip K. Dick in the meantime. We've had all kinds of other things in the 100 years since. But, you know, at the time he was writing, this was very far out. And even when it was first discovered, it was a little bit too, you know, for they discovered this trunk 10 years after he died. But for the first 30 years, they only published things by Ricardo Reis and Alberto Cairo and Alvaro de Campo, because those were the already published authors. It was like, it was too weird to start publishing by all these other ones. And so it wasn't until the 80s that they actually started publishing all this other stuff by all these other authors. And that's when scholars started, you know, by then a lot had happened in the world and scholars were now open to and interested in and excited about this exploration of identity. So that's a very brief exploration of Fernando Pessoa. I think you got at least as good a hit of him as I could give you, especially in this much time. I hope that it will pique your interest to at least poke around the internet and find out a little bit more. And also pique your interest to make sure you come back and listen to the rest of the series. But with the few minutes we have left, if anyone has a question, I would be more than willing to answer it. And I think there is a way that you can put your hand up and then I can unmute you.
I'm wondering if you mentioned that he was depressed. Did he ever consider the fact that he might be insane?
I don't know. I've never encountered him considering that. I have encountered other people considering that.
Yeah.
He felt that he wasn't insane. And I didn't pull this quote out for us, but there's a quote of his where he says, he says something, I'm really paraphrasing, but he says something about, you know, many geniuses are insane, right? But he can only respect an insane genius if they can prove to him that they can be normal. Because he said, it's hard for me to respect a genius who can't help but be insane. You know, the ones that are willing to be insane for their art, in spite of the fact that they could be normal, he has a lot of respect for. So I sort of interpreted that to mean that he considers himself that kind of person.
So his depression didn't put him over the edge.
Didn't seem to. You know, generally speaking, he was considered mild-mannered. He didn't speak much. He was incredibly private. Hardly anybody really knew him. But he wasn't disliked particularly, or, you know, I've never encountered a lot of stories that would indicate to me that he was insane and, you know, in a more of a clinical sense.
And he never had a family.
He lived with his mom and his sister and her family his whole life. Never had many friends, you know, acquaintances, in which he wrote about them a lot, but he didn't really get very close to many people.
Thank you.
Sure.
Jeff, hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Is it possible for us to just have a small taste of his poetry?
In Portuguese or English?
Possibly English, I think.
I'm asking just because I happen to have his Portuguese one here. Okay, well, let's give this a whirl. This is purely random. But it said, I have a bad cold. And everyone knows how bad colds throw the whole universe out of kilter. They turn us against life and make us sneeze even metaphysically. I've wasted the whole day blowing my nose. My head hurts all over. A sorry state for a minor poet. Today, I'm truly a minor poet. What I used to be was a wish. It snapped. Goodbye forever, fairy queen. You had wings of sunlight. And here I am, plodding along. I won't get well unless I lie down in bed. I've never been well except when lying down in the universe. Excuse me, what a terrible physical cold. I need truth and some aspirin. So there you go.
Thank you.
A little taste of Fernando Pessoa poetry. Of course, it's always tricky because it is true that all of the different people he wrote poetry under, the styles are different, the subject matter is different. That one that I just found was, at least it's cited on the internet as being in the name of Fernando Pessoa. So that is in theory at least his.
Thank you.
I just think it's interesting that to have those thousands of pages, that takes a lot of time. So it doesn't give him a lot of time to have a family and other friends,
no.
Especially if he's having conversations amongst and all the different people, that you'd have quite a social life if you know all these people with all these backstories. You don't have to go out of your house.
That's how he spoke about himself. You know, the reason he didn't have any friends was because he had so many friends. Friends of his dreams were the ones he chose to keep company with, rather than the physical friends in the world. He also said he didn't travel because it was, the places he could visit in his mind were more exciting than any place you could get to on a train. So he really was a kind of extraordinary dreamer. At least that's how he wrote about himself. And in some ways I can relate to that. In other ways, I think he far surpassed me in the capacity for dreaming. But yes, he just wrote all the time. Is what it sounds like. He did found a couple of literary magazines that were fairly short-lived. He was involved in the literary scene of the time to some extent. He wrote reviews, but like I said, he didn't really gain any fame at all until the very end of his life, when he published that book of poems.
I also wonder what his sister and his mother thought of him kind of being closeted away and doing so much writing, or how much they knew about what was really going on with him, from dinner table conversations or whatever.
I haven't gone deeply enough to find out anything. It'll be interesting though, another artist, a possibility poet who is not part of this series is Emily Dickinson. And similarly, all of her poems are in a trunk. There's another famous literary trunk finding where her, and in the people that we will speak about next week, Charles Sanders Peirce also, he developed his theories in the 1860s, 1870s, and they didn't really come to prominence until the 1930s and 40s. He was sort of completely forgotten about and then discovered. And similarly, Anais Nin wrote her diaries from early in the 20th century. They didn't get published until she was in her 60s. Even her childhood diaries didn't get published until much later. And I think in all of these cases, it's partly because they were just so far ahead of their time. A lot of what they were doing, it needed more decades to pass before there was going to be some openness to what they were creating.
Yeah. So Rick, her last name was Wolf, Virginia Wolf, who had a room of one's own. That seems so mild in comparison. It's like you could write a book, A Trunk of One's Own.
Yeah.
By herself.
Definitely. Well, fantastic. I want to thank you all so much for joining. I hope you had a good time. These are mainly meant to be educational and entertaining. So I hope you enjoyed learning about Fernando Pessoa. And I hope you look up more. And I hope you come back next week so I can talk to you about Charles Sanders Peirce, my favorite American philosopher. Very different and very the same in a lot of ways. So I guess by the end of this, we'll get more of a sense of what an artist of possibility is, because we'll see what's the same about all these people, even though they're all so dramatically different. So thank you all very much.